Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Among the many challenges our country is facing are those to the First Amendment's protections of freedom of the press and against censorship. As protests have taken place around the country, the incidents of law enforcement targeting journalists with force, even arresting them while on the air, can be viewed as censorship. Social media, for the most part, has refused to censor participants, but when Twitter fact-checked a presidential tweet, the president accused them of censorship. There are those who view as censorship the president's admonition to governors to dominate the protesters with shows of force. The First Amendment guarantees several of our most cherished values: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And perhaps the most important value of all, freedom of the press, for without a watchdog to keep government honest and inform the electorate, democracy cannot function. Attacks on the media have been unprecedented in their frequency and ferocity since the beginnings of the Trump administration, now with examples of intimidation of the press caught on tape during these demonstrations and examples of peaceful protesters being denied their right to demonstrate in some cities. We spend the hour looking at a First Amendment in crisis. For this discussion, we're joined by Philip Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke University and author of Social Media and Public Interest: Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. He joins us from Durham. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
And Courtney Ratch is advocacy director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. She works on behalf of journalistic freedom all over the world. Her book, Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change, was published in 2016. Good morning to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And let me begin with you, Courtney. We have witnessed instances of press intimidation by law enforcement in various places around the country during this crisis, during these protests. Your organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, reports at least 125 press freedom violations in just the first 3 days of the protests. And I believe we are now in day 10. So that was days ago. Are these instances of just individual bad actors, bad cops, with their own fears, their own agendas, or were they executing, do you know, some policy that came down from higher ups?
Sure. So first of all, as you mentioned, this was 3 days ago. So since then, we are now investigating more than 230 incidents of anti-press violence. Now, let's be clear that we are investigating. It's going to take time for us to independently verify everything. But what we see from what we know thus far is that there is definitely some targeting of journalists happening. These journalists were, in many cases, clearly identified as journalists, carrying, you know, heavy equipment of journalism, cameras, identified as press, wearing flak jackets, wearing their credentials, identifying themselves as journalists, and yet were targeted by tear gas, by rubber bullets, and in some cases assaulted by police. We don't know that this is a coordinated or, you know, that there's any, you know, message on high, for example, but we do know that this is a major abrogation of the First Amendment, and we can't really think of anything like this in recent memory. It's really unprecedented. Violence against journalists during protests, not unprecedented. It's quite common. The targeting of journalists, especially despite the fact that they've identified themselves as such, is unprecedented.
Well, there was an incident, and I think it was caught on Facebook, of journalists in New York City recently, in the last day or two, during peaceful demonstrations, being asked by police to move, and they did. And then the police told them to leave immediately, right now, go. And he said, no, we're media, we're press, we have a right to be here. We have been deemed essential workers, and police officers, essential by to whom? Why are you essential? And essentially told him to leave. Well, that the essential worker policy comes from the COVID-19 process. But in normal circumstances, are journalists essential to the process?
I mean, absolutely. Journalists are essential to our ability as citizens to hold our country accountable, to hold our elected leaders accountable. They are essential to ensuring that the public is informed, that they're aware. I think the fact that journalists were deemed essential during COVID is perfectly illustrative of this. You know, most of the information that people know about how to keep themselves safe, about, you know, the curfews that were imposed here in Washington and other cities around the country, you know, basic information is from journalists. So they are essential and they're recognized. There is a specific protection for journalists, for the press in the First Amendment. So it is both, you know, the First Amendment protects the rights to freedom of expression and the rights of a free press. And part of that means that you have to allow journalists to be out reporting. This has been, you know, there's lots of case law on this. In fact, we signed on to a letter by the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press that they sent to the Minnesota police, where they lay out all of the legal backing for why journalists are permitted to be out reporting on these clearly newsworthy, once in a lifetime events.
Philip Napoli, law enforcement, people have been talking about this for days since the president made his little walk across the street to the church to hold up a Bible. But in an effort to do that, they had to clear a whole area in front of the White House, and they did it relatively roughly. And in fact, police, if you look at the video, you can say, I think beyond a shadow of a doubt, that police attacked journalists. They attacked a crew from Australia. So this has been seen all over the world by taking their shields and literally punching photographers and people holding microphones to get them out of the way. And everybody was peaceful. It wasn't a riot situation. Could these things and other incidents like them, the arresting of the crew in Minneapolis while they were live on CNN, could they be viewed as censorship or attempts at censorship, or is it just wrongdoing in the course of trying to control a situation?
Well, I think it very much can be interpreted as censorship, because what we're talking about here are a couple of things. One is denial of access to a location where something newsworthy is happening, and therefore the reporter is unable to report on it. And then there is just censorship through intimidation. Right. And the chilling effect, that's a concept that's, I think, very relevant to what we're seeing over this past week. This idea that reporters might be intimidated to even try to cover certain issues or go to certain places out of fear of being attacked in this way.
You cover these incidences, your organization, Courtney, all over the world. And I would think where there is not a tradition of a free press, where the countries do not have First Amendment protections, that intimidation is pretty effective, because we're talking about regimes that might harm you, jail you, etc. Because of the existence and the historic existence of the First Amendment in this country, is it more difficult to intimidate the press?
I think that it is more difficult to do it in some ways, but not in other ways. So the mobilization of military vehicles, of incredibly militarized police. Here in DC, I was just reading an article this morning about how many different types of military and law enforcement troops are here, many of which we don't even know what they are. They don't have name tags on. They don't have insignia indicating who they're representing. That is intimidating. I see from my social media feed that, you know, this is concerning to journalists. They don't know, you know, who they're potentially talking to, who potentially is attacking them. So, you know, what we see around the world is that when law enforcement mobilizes in this way and is able to attack journalists with impunity, so facing no repercussions, not being held accountable for upholding the rights of journalists to report freely and safely, that has an intimidation effect. It sends a signal that, you know, these people can work with impunity to restrict the rights of the press to report. So this is really concerning to see this in the United States. You know, I lived in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East, and this reminds me what I'm seeing, you know, on the social media feed, on the news, in my own hometown in DC, reminds me of the Arab Spring. You have seen police on horseback running over protesters. An Australian journalist was beat with a shield by a cop or a military, who knows, on live TV. You know, Reuters, Vice, major news organizations where, again, they're clearly identified as press, not to mention the citizen journalists, not to mention the freelancers who are out there working on their own. Because let's be clear, there are protests around the United States in dozens and dozens of cities. So you've got journalists out there in every city, some more resourced than others. And it is intimidating. And we know that because we hear that from the journalists that we're talking to.
Dr. Napoli.
And I think this issue also needs to be put in context in terms of what's been happening to journalism over the past decade or more, which is that economically, it's being gutted. So there are fewer reporters out there than there would normally be, because news organizations are so under-resourced, their economic model has collapsed. So it's easier to create news vacuum, so to speak, because there's fewer reporters out there. And similarly, these news organizations are not nearly as resourced as they once were. So, you know, the resources to take legal action when being intimidated or censored against or any of that are vastly diminished. So it's a hobbled institution that's out there still trying to do its job. And in that way, I think more vulnerable to these tactics than they have been in years past.
We're going to spend most of the hour talking. Go ahead, Courtney. I'm sorry, Dr. Ratch.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that because in addition, I mean, you're absolutely right, Dr. Napoli, that you know, we've seen the evisceration of local news. What this also means is that, you know, the police and the reporters reporting on them don't really know each other. In many cases, you no longer have the relationship so that, you know, when you see that local journalist on the front lines, you know, okay, that's, you know, our community journalist. And that has, I think, broad repercussions as well for how the press is being treated and what the situation is in here in the protests. And I hope at some point, you know, today we're going to talk about the militarization of the police and their tactics and what that means for journalists covering the protests.
Well, let me ask you about that, because obviously the militarization of the police is for multi-pronged reasons, I would imagine. It's because in some cases they may be these heavy weapons and these heavy vehicles and the heavy armor that they're wearing may in fact be necessary if violence were to get out of hand, I suppose. On the other hand, it is to send a message. Don't screw with us, because we have the upper hand. Could that be the militarization of the police in force on a public street during a peaceful protest? Could that be viewed as censorship? Because it's certainly an attempt to, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a form of, as we talked about, intimidation earlier. You know, we found that this has been an issue for several years. In Ferguson, this was actually specifically raised by the Justice Department. And when we went in 2016 for a U.S. press freedom mission or 2017 to understand what are the dynamics on the ground facing local press, this issue of increasing militarization and aggressive tactics by the police. On the one hand, they've gotten equipment and surveillance technology and more aggressive tactics such as kettling. And, you know, you have a lot of veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan going into the police forces. So you've got this real, you know, different view, different perspective of the police on public life.
Dr. Courtney Ratch is Advocacy Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Dr. Philip Napoli, Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. We're talking about censorship, wide and narrow, and we're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the First Amendment in crisis, if that's a way to describe it. Certainly being tested at the moment during these protests and demonstrations in our country, because the First Amendment covers a lot of different things, among them freedom of the press. Courtney Ratch is with us, Advocacy Director of Committee to Protect Journalists and the author of Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change. And she's already said that the Arab Spring is kind of reminiscent of what's happening now in certain parts of our country with these protests. Dr. Philip Napoli is also here, professor of public policy at Duke University, author of Social Media and Public Interest Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. And we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about social media as we go through this program. CNN's Brian Stelter says that when a journalist is arrested at a protest, the free and fair gathering of the news is arrested too. Are there universally recognized rules of performance that governing how journalists are supposed to act in the gathering of news and the observation of what's going on so they can report on it? Are there recognized rules of performance, Dr. Ratch?
I think that it depends. There are certainly principles that define journalism. So actually, one of the chapters in my book is trying to think about what makes something citizen journalism versus other journalism. But the very basic premise of journalism is that it is fact-based, it is accurate, it is timely, it attempts to not necessarily have a balance, but you know that balance or fulcrum on which you balance is going to be different depending on your perspective. So, you know, you can't say that someone doing citizen journalism or gonzo journalism or activist journalism is necessarily doing the same thing that maybe a mainstream journalist is doing or somebody who works for a mainstream outlet. But that doesn't mean that it's not journalism. And I think we have to make space for all types of journalism. You know, in our country, in our world, we want those different perspectives. You know, we relied so much on the citizen journalism reporting during the Arab Spring because we weren't getting good reporting in many cases from the state-controlled or state-influenced media in those cases. You know, here in the United States, of course, we're getting great coverage from professional journalists, but we're also getting really important information and evidence and reporting from people who are doing acts of journalism in the street.
And in fact, in other countries where state-controlled media doesn't report or reports in a very circumspect way, they have shut down social media reporting because they've turned off these networks so that they cannot report. In this country, we seem to be going after, some people seem to be going after legitimate, credentialed journalists from networks and television stations and newspapers by getting them out of the way, punching them, doing things that you, cursing at them, doing things that you wouldn't associate with America. While at the same time, social media people with their phones are out there disseminating information that sometimes is missed by legitimate reporters. Dr. Napoli, since we haven't shut that down in this country yet, and probably can't because of the First Amendment, is this attempt to silence legitimately credentialed journalists misplaced? Because it's going to get out anyway.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And you know, the early sort of models for citizen journalism were much more dependent on sort of our traditional news media to serve an amplification function. Even early research on how things went viral online. If I video something on my phone and posted it to my social media account, it going viral often depended on either a news outlet or a celebrity, somebody retweeting it and really fanning the flames. But now, as the number of people on social media has grown, that's not as essential part of the process anymore. And it all really points to this, you know, interesting double-edged sword that social media has become. On the one hand, it does allow for that kind of information to bubble up where it might not otherwise have. On the other hand, it also provides this opportunity for so many bad actors to masquerade as either legitimate or citizen journalists. Right. and use this, as has happened in the case of the protests, use the protests as an opportunity to intentionally disseminate disinformation.
Dr. Ratch, your organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, says police cannot arrest journalists in retaliation for negative coverage or to prevent reporting on a public demonstration. Police may not prevent journalists from covering protests if the journalists are in a place where the public is allowed to be and they are not disrupting or interfering with law enforcement. Simply being near a protest or other newsworthy event is not a crime. Are there laws to back that up, or is that simply what the Committee to Protect Journalists would like to have honored?
There are laws to back that up. And I mean, I think, first of all, the main law being the First Amendment. Again, it does protect the rights of journalists. And we saw also, for example, that in some curfew designations, the media was exempted. But I would point again to our colleagues at the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, which we work with closely because they're all lawyers. We are advocates and reporters. But they have gone through in a very detailed way in this letter to Minnesota officials and the police, citing all of the case law that clearly protects the right of the press to document police activities in public, the right to record them by both the press and the public, which has been repeatedly and clearly established in several courts around the country. We've seen the Department of Justice, which has taken a position that this right to record law enforcement is crucial to the First Amendment and that it should be applied across the country. We've seen that there is case law that ensures that journalists, photojournalists, and documentary filmmakers are entitled to relief, which allows them to, sue officials if they violate these rights. So there are very established legal rights that exist for the rights of journalists. And I think that if we look at the number of incidents, first of all, arrests, there is still a reporter behind bars in New York City who was arrested yesterday, Anna Slatz, who's a Canadian journalist working for Rebel News, still behind bars. How is that possible? We've seen at least 20 arrests of journalists during the protests throughout the country. And this is unparalleled in American history.
So is this coming from a central location? I mean, that I think that's a question that needs to be answered. Is this coming because the president of the United States has said, dominate the crowd, get tough on these people? Or is it coming from individual actors who watch Fox News? Dr. Napoli?
Well, I think, if you think about the past 3-4 years, the top-down message has been one of demonizing the press. This president has been more aggressive in going as far as to declare the press the enemy of the people. And so anybody, any citizen of this country who is, sympathetic to the president's views on in general or is a fan is likely to absorb that perspective as well. And so, my fear is that we're seeing a lot of folks in law enforcement who are acting in a way that they assume is the way the president would want them to act, because
let me be frank. Who gives a damn how the president wants people to react? It strikes me that calling the press the enemy of the people may not be unconstitutional, but it is certainly un-American.
Absolutely. And I would love to be able to say that the number of people who give a damn about those kind of statements is small, but public opinion numbers.
But if you're a police officer, you're operating under certain rules and regulations, and I'm sure they take some sort of oath to uphold the law. The law, the basis of the law, is the United States Constitution.
Couldn't agree more. I'm just trying to imagine the mindset at work in the behaviors that we're seeing and trying to explain it. And that would be my best guess. I think if you were to ask many of these people why they're doing what they're doing, it would not surprise me if they said, well, this is how I feel about the press. And in their minds, they are acting against criminals because they've been told as much and they've chosen to believe as much.
Okay. I know that you want to comment on this, Dr. Ratch, but I also want to get your take on this because you look at this worldwide. You look at how this, how reporters and journalism functions worldwide, and government attempts to control those journalists. And the dialogue that has come out of the White House about journalists and about the press being the enemy of the people and about it disseminating fake news, those are the words of dictators and autocrats in highly controlling regimes around the country. These are not words that should come out of the mouth of a duly elected president of the United States. It's reprehensible. So if you say it enough and it's coming from the top down, people are going to eventually believe it and change their minds about how a free press functions in a country. Is that what's happening here?
I think that this fake news rhetoric has been really detrimental, not only to journalists here and to the press here in the United States, but around the world. So, of course, it sends a message, this constant denigration of the press, the targeting and vilification of individual journalists and media outlets. And we've seen that that can translate into actual online harassment and harm to those journalists when they're targeted, especially on the Twitter feed, but also, you know, in his daily comments. But we also see around the world that this fake news rhetoric has proliferated in the past 3 years by, you know, authoritarian and democratic leaders alike, from Poland and Hungary, which have seen severe declines in press freedom, through to, you know, China, Russia, and Egypt, which love to refer to this and protect, you know, their crackdowns under the guise of this fake news rhetoric. And we've seen an increase, for example, with the coronavirus, in the expansion of fake news laws and disinformation laws, again, as cover to restrict independent and critical journalism. Now, here we have not seen yet the rhetoric translate into law, but you see, you know, this violence happening, and we're, according to the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, which is where we're trying to aggregate all of these incidents, at the moment we're investigating more than 233, the breakdown of incidents shows that about, of the 153 assaults so far, 125 of those are by police and 27 by others. So yes, we should be concerned about the rhetoric and the signal that that sends to the public. But right now, it seems like the majority of violence is coming from the authorities, who are actually supposed to be protecting the rights that are enshrined in the First Amendment. And I would also add that this is, you know, this latest crackdown is having a massively negative impact on journalists around the world and undermining U.S. leadership, where we have Russia's foreign ministry coming out and talking about how it's unacceptable for U.S. law enforcement, you know, officials to use these tactics. We have Turkey's communications director saying that press freedom is the backbone of democracy, and Turkey is the second leading jailer of journalists in the world. This is not good for U.S. leadership. It is not good for press freedom anywhere in the world.
Philip Napoli.
Just jumping on one of the things, Courtney, you mentioned about how we have not seen any lawmaking yet, you know, directed at journalism. But we have seen, as of last week, the White House issue an executive order specifically directed at regulating social media platforms. And the aspect of that I think that's most troubling is the impetus for that executive order was Twitter's decision to place a fact check alongside one of President Trump's tweets. And so the idea of fact checking, which is our, you could argue, our most objective, our most robust form of journalism that we have left in this country, that the act of a fact check could motivate a regulatory intervention into the social media space is certainly concerning, and hopefully not a slippery slope for more efforts to try to muzzle the press.
And we can talk about this, and we will, but let's, you brought it up, so let's talk about it now. The executive order, if it stands, and I'm not sure it will because I'm not sure it's legal, but it would work against the president, it seems to me, because the president is upset because they fact-checked one of his or two of his tweets. They did not censor him and they did not take the post down. They simply fact checked it. He says under this executive order that from going forward, these social media platforms who have not been responsible for the content that people post on those platforms would now be responsible. They would then have to take down posts that are irresponsible or are wrong, putting them in a very awkward position, one presumes. But they would have to take down his posts. What is he thinking?
Well, and that's the irony about the executive order. It's a bit, what's the word I'm looking for? Inconsistent. There's also a point later on in the executive order where it says that these social media platforms should be passive billboards. I think what it ultimately might be trying to achieve is the idea of, through the threat of the kind of requirements that you describe, that the platforms revert to being just that, passive billboards that don't engage in any kind of fact-checking or content moderation.
You got Jack Dorsey at Twitter saying we will now fact-check the president. You got Mark Zuckerberg, who runs Facebook, who has steadfastly rejected any notion that his platform is responsible for anything and that they have no responsibility to police what people post, no matter what its impact may be on society. Well, if he did, would that be censorship? And how should we feel about somebody who says, I don't care what happens, I don't care what the impact on America is or the world is, here it is, use it. How should we feel about either of those things?
Well, it's a very interesting sort of moment of reckoning here for these platforms. And it's not that different from the debate that was happening in the traditional news media over the past few months around something as simple as, hey, you know, do we continue to cover the president's press conferences if he is using them as an opportunity to disseminate misinformation?
And clearly he is. He's told 19,000 falsehoods.
And from my perspective, gatekeeping is gatekeeping. So whether you are a news outlet like NPR or you are a platform like Twitter or Facebook, this process of being a distributor of content has to come with some public service criteria that you apply. Otherwise, again, what we've created is, and we've seen this over the past decade, to see social media evolve from a tool to facilitate the Arab Spring to what it has become. If we don't take a lesson in that, we're just sowing the seeds for the continued erosion of our democracy.
But if we start censoring social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat and things like that, is that censorship or is it not censorship because these are private companies? We'll get an answer to that question when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. At Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, I'm Mike Collins. Collins, we're talking about censorship and potential censorship and in the age of COVID-19 and these protests around the country with Dr. Courtney Ratch, an advocacy director of the Committee to Protect Journalists and the author of Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Egypt, Digital Dissidents and Political Change, and Dr. Philip Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke University, author of Social Media and Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. So we were talking about social media just before the break, Dr. Napoli, and I'm just curious whether there's a law about this or where you stand on this, because a censorship that comes down from the United States government is one thing. It's another thing for Jack Dorsey, who runs Twitter, or Mark Zuckerberg, who runs Facebook, to decide the policy at my platform is going to be this, and therefore if you say X, we're going to take it down. We're going to censor you. Is that censorship, and is that kind of censorship protected under the First Amendment, or is it because it's a private company? It's not censorship.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that's editorial decision-making. The challenging situation we have here is that, as we've known for years, whether it's Rupert Murdoch or Ted Turner or any other media mogul that's operated large news operations in the past, they've been able to have their individual preferences reflected in the content that they disseminate, and to be able to do that free of accusations of being censors. Right. The difference in this context, there are a couple. One is that these platforms have built their business around hosting third-party content, that they're not content creators, they're distributors only. And so that, and they have in doing, building that business, have projected themselves as sort of these neutral conduits. It's important to know that though the courts have never yet specified that any part of the internet is a public forum. The internet has all aspects of the internet have become essentially privatized. So, you know, the law as it relates to a Twitter or a Facebook is not really any different than it relates to a Fox News or an NBC. However, these platforms are also protected by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which also grants them additional freedom, so to speak, in that they are not liable for the content that they host. So they are simultaneously empowered to edit, and if you want to use the word censor, and at the same time, not liable for anything potentially problematic that leaks through their efforts, right? And then finally, to wrap it up, but the other part of this that does represent kind of a difference is that these platforms have gotten so big. Mm-hmm. Their reach, the reach of a Facebook is unprecedented in our media history. And so that is where I think we start to feel uncomfortable and should about sort of the gatekeeping power that an individual like Mark Zuckerberg has compared to, say, a Rupert Murdoch in the past.
But the First Amendment protects us from censorship, theoretically speaking, and certainly attempts at censorship by the government at any level. But does it protect us from censorship, and should it, and how should we feel about censorship coming from a private company? Is it different in any way?
And we've had regulations in the past that have been directed at that very issue, to try to acknowledge that there are some contexts where speech can be limited by private actors, right? So we have had media regulations that, for example, that have limited the extent to which one company can own multiple media outlets. So it's typically been what we would call structural approaches to that problem, not behavioral approaches, which of course leads us to the question that's been percolating in various policy spheres over the past year or so, which is the right solution to this to break some of these companies up, you know, to force Facebook to divest itself of Instagram, of WhatsApp, and to structurally limit the ability of any of these platforms to control the flow of speech online. But the other part of this too, is it raises such an interesting debate, which is freedom of speech versus freedom of reach, right? You know, do each of us have a right to have our ideas and viewpoints accelerated on social media? There was a time, you know, when if you had opinions, you posted them on your blog and nobody but your three best friends ever read it. That model of the entire model of the internet has changed. And that's something that we're grappling with now.
Dr. Ratch.
Yeah, I think so first of all, the First Amendment only protects people against, protects the rights against government censorship. But I think right. To get to build on what Dr. Napoli is talking about, you know, a lot of the most problematic aspects of the social media ecosystem don't actually have to do with the content that's being posted. Right? It's about how that content is targeted or micro-targeted at people or communities. It's about how it is commercialized and the ad tech behind it that allows for these incredibly sophisticated profiles to be identified so that you can target that blog that used to have three people reading it to, you know, 50 others that are going to be really potentially influenced by it, right? So I think part of what would be helpful is to reframe the discussion from one about, you know, censorship online and think about that exact question around, you know, do you have the right to post? Do you have the freedom to post? And is that different than the right to have it amplified, right? And you've seen platforms taking different approaches to this. They have demonetized some sites, they have de-amplified some sites, and in some cases, they've removed it. I think we have to also recognize that there is the potential for government censorship via private platform. So we've seen this in, for example, the countering violent extremism space, where governments are pressuring private platforms to take down certain content. They're using internet referral units or other, you know, bypassing legal processes or any sort of open process to use the terms of service of that platform to get content taken down. That is a form of censorship when governments are using, you know, the private platform's terms of service to get content taken down. But let's not confuse, you know, the editorial decision-making of the platforms, their choices. We want platforms, for example, there's a Reddit page that's all about cats. You can't post anything besides a cat. Are we trying to say they're not allowed to do that? You know, there are many communities, you know, minoritized communities or communities at risk who gather in places online to communicate, and they want to do that safely and they want to do that, you know, comfortably. Are we saying that there shouldn't be allowed, we shouldn't have allowed the platforms to create those communities? So I think, again, taking it out of the speech realm and focusing on these other issues like, you know, the design of the technology platform, what it allows, ensuring greater transparency around some of the decision making would be a good way to reframe this debate, so we don't get into this, you know, is it censorship or not, and spend all this time thinking about what content should be allowed or not.
Dr. Napoli.
Just jumping off on something that Dr. Ratch said, which is, you know, this concern about government censorship via private platform. I think that's why the news reports this week of the phone conversations between President Trump and Mark Zuckerberg make a lot of people ill at ease. You know, we wonder what they might be talking about.
Right. let me turn this around for a second, because in his attack on Twitter, President Trump says that social media outlets have been suppressing and censoring conservative voices. I don't know if there's any truth to that, given the fact that he's told 19,000 falsehoods in the course of his presidency, but do you know if there's any truth to that? Okay. So,
there are studies that have been done that show that that is not accurate. We have not done the studies ourselves, but Data and Society and others have done those studies.
But there are also accusations on the right social media skew their algorithms to discriminate against people on the right. One conservative outlet alleged that 96% of Google search results for Donald Trump prioritize left-leaning and anti-Trump media outlets. Could that be true? And if so, is the minimization of one side or the other of political thought censorship? Doctor,
one of the challenges there, and this goes to the research that's been done in this space as well, which is this, is that that process of curating content, there are so many variables that go into that order in terms of what's presented and what's not. Whether the content was conservative or liberal is probably not even a variable that enters into how these algorithms operate. Now, it could be factors that correlate with that, which sadly, and there's research that bears this out quite strongly, which is if the algorithm is designed to you know, de-emphasize content that disseminates false information. Unfortunately, the numbers show that that happens more often in right-leaning than left-leaning news outlets. So that's just one example of the kind of factors that could be at work there. But I have seen studies that have suggested, and that's always the question, what is the reason? Is it ideology? This is what really got a lot of the initial controversy around the role of social media in political discourse started back in 2015 or as early 2016, when there were accusations that Facebook's trending topics editors were favoring liberal news outlets and eliminating conservative news outlets and their stories from the trending topics list. And that trending topics list subsequently just went away. First, they tried to use algorithms instead of humans. That made it a breeding ground for blatant disinformation. And then they just decided to get rid of it because they couldn't seem to figure out a happy medium, humans with their own personal biases, algorithms with their inherent limitations.
But algorithms are written by people. And none of us mere mortals understand anything about them or how they do what they do. And how do you know? How would I know? How would anybody know? How would the president know? How would the Congress know whether algorithms are deliberately taking sides?
Right. And well,
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that's an interesting point, which goes to this issue of transparency. So, I mean, we do know some things about algorithms because some of the companies do tell us when they update their algorithms at times. For example, we're going to prioritize news from your friends over news from corporate or third parties. And that had a huge impact on the news industry around the world. We saw local news outlets, because they tested this in Southeast Asia first, you know, just have their revenues eviscerated. And then they rolled that out and that led to more false news. And they tell us the signals that they use, for example, on Google News or on recommendations, which include link backs, authoritative sources. So we do know some things about the algorithms. But of course, we don't know enough. And this is a problem not only in the algorithms of the social media platform, but in the algorithms of predictive policing, et cetera. We need transparency around this if we're going to be able to hold them accountable.
Social media platforms have traditionally let it all hang out, to use an old phrase from the 1960s and 70s. In other words, they haven't policed what people are posting for the most part. And we have seen instances during these demonstrations of known white supremacist groups opening Twitter accounts in the guise of being left-wing Antifa groups and inciting people to take action that a liberal left-leaning organization might incite were they actually posting. But it's actually right-wing groups doing this to inflame the passions in the street. So if we have bad actors in the street inflaming passions, the police generally take them off the street. Should we be taking these people off social media? Is that
Absolutely.
Censorship?
And Twitter has been doing that, as I understand. It violates some of their policies around fake accounts. So, as they always say, it's a game of whack-a-mole in terms of trying to identify these bad actors and get them off the platform before the content that they disseminate goes viral. But that is actually, you know, one of the spaces where there is, you know, fairly little ambiguity at this point. When you start impersonating other actors to disseminate disinformation, you're in violation of their policies. But a lot of these, and then times they use bots as well to amplify this further, which is another dimension of sort of fake accounts online and whether that should even be permissible at all.
So I have about a minute left. And I'd like to hear from both of you, if time allows, on this. In spite of occasional examples of overzealous law enforcement during these protests, and despite journalists having had negative encounters with police, this nation has never seen anything like what's going on in the streets right now, and has for 10 days. And I would think they are being driven by social consciousness and anger and frustration, but also because of images seen on TV and through social media. There have been nearly 2 weeks of these demonstrations. Does that say something about the endurance of the First Amendment? I have it 30 seconds, Dr. Ratch.
I think it says something about the endurance of the First Amendment and the endurance of journalists who are out there at great personal risk to bring us the news, because this is an incredibly important social justice movement. You know, police brutality affects so many people, the minority communities and journalists themselves. And now they're having to wear body armor and goggles. And I just hope that journalists know that we appreciate the work they're doing and that they can get safety advice on CPJ.org.
Dr. Napoli. Very quickly.
I think it's that, plus we're basically seeing a perfect storm of social and economic conditions that include the coronavirus, 3+ years of a administration that's fairly hostile to the press and to civil rights.
Philip Napoli, Duke University Public Policy Professor, Courtney Ratch, Advocacy Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.